Could you imagine that by the age of 20 years old, you could be taking care of the number one expense for Americans or for people in the world, which is their shelter?
Joy Dev Mitra, aka JD. JD was born and raised in the Bronx.
Grew up in the Bronx. I had immigrant parents that migrated from India. My dad came here with $8 in his pocket.
You've got this culture that's kind of tugging at you from two sides. You've got the Bronx, and then you've got your Indian heritage and culture.
I was always trying to figure out how to fit in. There was a part of me that wanted to live my life. There was a part of me that wanted to like satisfy my family and their wishes. Well, if my parents let me live my life, I wouldn't have to be so dishonest. So I had made up that the only value that I really bring to the table is my ability to earn.
You purchased this building and I really wanted to dive into real estate.
$458,000 for this property. Like, how in the world? This is like a robbery without a gun. And we were like, holy shit, I think we just found something. We were killing the game with this thing. All right, let's get another one.
How would somebody who has very limited means get into the Airbnb game?
This is another way, and it's really something that a lot of young people are just killing the game on right now, which is...
Welcome to another episode of the Real Mentors Podcast. And as always, real stands for real examples, altering lives. Today, I'm honored, privileged, and excited to have a guest that's going to hopefully drop some really, really, really shiny gems on us. It's a personal friend of mine, which always makes my life easier because I don't have to prepare. It's just like having a natural conversation. So welcome to the studio. My guest today, Mr. Joy Dev Mitra, aka JD. Welcome to the show, my brother.
Thank you, brother. Honored to be here, man.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a long time coming. We've attempted this in the garage with terrible lighting and a virtual setup from
Humble
Texas.
Beginnings.
Humble beginnings. Shout out to Jeremy for introducing us.
That's right.
And setting us down this path. Here we are, maybe what, 2 years later?
Has it been? Wow, I can't even believe the time flies. That's amazing. Maybe.
Yeah,
it probably has.
We're probably pushing 2 years.
Life is flying, man.
Life is flying. And the changes in both of our lives individually has been so dramatic. Jay-Z. Now I'm really making you a superstar. JD's a recovering fat boy like me. And yes. I've seen him just turn the corner and go all in on the gym and nutrition. So it's been exciting to watch him just change his body and his life. And today I have him here to tell us a little bit about his own journey in real estate specifically. Now, JD was born and raised in the Bronx, hence why we get along so well. Tell us a little bit about your story growing up, where you come from, and
yeah, man,
beginnings.
Totally. So grew up in the Bronx, had immigrant parents that migrated from India in 1968. My dad, he loves to tell the story of how he came here with $8 in his pocket and he got an apartment and he got a job. And then a month later, he brought his pregnant wife, my mother, over with what would be my sister eventually. And they grinded, you know, they grinded. They have the whole old immigrant story, the American dream. And he raised us in a very Indian way. We were raised as Hindus in the Bronx,
right,
of all places.
So he's not Puerto Rican, although he can pass for one.
Oh, I get that all the time. Everything but Indian, basically, right? Dominican, Puerto Rican. So, yeah, we grew up in a very Indian way, and it was kind of an interesting situation in a sense that, you know, I'm like Joey Bag of Donuts from the Bronx, like growing up in an Irish Italian neighborhood in Pelham Parkway. And then I, like, you know, the kids are asking questions like, why does your mom have like a red dot on her head? Or, you know, why is she wearing like a blanket for clothing? So I had to deal with like some of that,
right,
which was kind of interesting. It helped me learn how to be a bit of a chameleon, I think, to be honest. And it ended up being a skill set that I was able to use and monetize later, to be quite honest. But really learning how to meet people where they're at and just understand people, like learn about people. And it was definitely tough at times, not really knowing who I was. Like, who am I really? Am I an American kid that like I felt like I was, you know, growing up playing baseball, doing all the things from the kids that the kids from the block did. And at the same time, having parents and a family that had great tradition that dated back more than two centuries in India. We can literally trace both my mother's side and my father's side back, you know, six generations at least. Wow. And tradition is really big in India. So I think that that was something that really played a part in just being confused as a kid. And then later on in adulthood, learning how valuable it was to actually come from such a rich culture and so on and so forth. So, yeah, in many ways, a normal childhood, and in many ways, definitely not a normal childhood. One of the things that I really loved is we grew up in a business family, and my mom and dad always talk business. Like at the kitchen table, they were talking about, you know, whose delivery needed to go out and all these different things. And while it was annoying as a kid, I learned to appreciate it later on, because obviously later on I became an entrepreneur. So I have great love for my parents, for, you know, all the lessons they taught me as a small business owner. And that's a little bit about my childhood. And
so tell us a little bit about growing up, having to be a chameleon, because I know as a child, that's probably not easy to navigate, but I'm already hearing that you've got strong parents in the household. They've got the prototypical immigrant, left everything we know for the American dream mentality. So they're balls to the wall. They're going to make it work.
For sure.
And you're just a fly on the wall, and you're a kid just trying to figure shit out. Like, what am I? Who am I? You know, these guys are making fun of you. And to some extent, you know, it's what kids do.
Right.
Right. And that's where we kind of maybe get that message lost today. So that's what kids do. They say what they see.
Yeah.
They don't have a filter. They don't necessarily know they're being mean, although obviously that changes as we get older. So you've got these mentors in your two parents, and you've got this culture that's kind of tugging at you from two sides. You've got the Bronx.
Yep.
And you're in Pelham Parkway, so you don't look like anybody, because if you grew up somewhere else in the Bronx, you might be able to fit in better. But that wasn't the case. And then you've got your Indian heritage and culture. And I know your story personally. I'm not necessarily sure if you're willing to share it, but I know that that culture would then find you in a marriage later on. And then you'd have to navigate that to eventually become your true authentic self. Would you mind sharing a little bit
Please.
About that?
Yeah, and how absolutely. Culture played that part? I'd be happy to. I mean, my whole childhood, I felt that in some way I was always trying to figure out how to fit in. I was either trying to figure out how to fit into my own family and all the rituals and all the expectations that they had. My father told me at a very young age, when I was like 8 years old, that if you have premarital sex, you're not going to be able to put the fire out in my mouth when they cremate me, because you're my only son. And basically there would be nobody to put the fire in my mouth. I mean, like heavy stuff, you know, to say to your son. Right. And I didn't even know what sex was at that age, you know, that early in age. So it was just really, really confusing and like a lot of pressure, you know. At the same time, growing up in an Italian neighborhood, that came with its own set of pressures, you know, and how to act, how to be, how to talk, how to, you know, how to do everything.
Right.
later on in life, as I wanted to start dating and things like that, you know, I was always into Spanish girls. I was always into the Latinas. So for me, guilty. Like that was guilty. Right. And you know, that was like taboo. Like that was just like, you know, my parents, once they got wind of that, they were like, all right, we need to get this kid married. Right. And
are you 12 at this point?
No. I'm 25 at this point. I graduated from college. I joined the family business.
Which is?
So we were, so basically what was happening at the time, when I was about 19, 20 years old, I would come visit my dad's business. He had a business that was in large part failing at the time. It was a plumbing business, and he was trying to bring in products and resell them, basically be a wholesaler to these different stores that he was trying to sell to. And I, in college, was... I was doing telemarketing. And the reason I was doing telemarketing is because minimum wage back in like 1996 was $4.25 an hour being a busboy.
Yeah.
So you know what? They were paying $10 to work in a call center with air conditioning. I said, listen, I can do that. And I jumped on the phone. I realized that I was really good at phone sales. And I was really good at rejection and being able to play the numbers. And, you know, I over time, you know, cutting my teeth on learning that the more no's I got, the closer I was to a yes. And that really, I didn't even know at the time that that was going to actually serve me. I thought it was just that it was going to pay me more money per hour at the job on campus. Little did I know that that was actually going to be like the secret to the beginning of my success in sales. So when I graduated, I saw my dad was in this business and he wasn't doing well. They were thinking about shutting it down. They were thinking about retiring, moving back to India. And I was, this is like 96 where they didn't even have phones yet. Right. So I was like flipping through the white pages and the yellow pages. You guys remember what the yellow pages were, well, right?
Some of our viewers may not. I joked before it was this thick stack they dropped in the lobby.
That's
you
right.
You actually had to dial the number really slowly.
Right. So flipping through the yellow pages, no Google for sure. And just calling, just like, hey, my name's JD Mitra. I want to earn your business. Hey, my name's JD Mitra. I want to earn your business. And just calling different plumbing supplies. And I realized what my dad was up against and why he wasn't able to generate sales. It was a very Jewish industry. And at the time, it was really hard for like a brown man to get in and, you know, really, if they weren't vastly different in price, there was no reason. If everything was equal, they were giving the business to their own.
Naturally.
They were taking care of their own, right?
Naturally.
And I respected that. So, you know, I was like, listen, I'm just going to play the numbers and I'm just going to call a lot of people. And I got really good at sales. And that was probably the beginning of my success in growing the business. And while that was going on parallel to that, I started dating. You know, I actually started dating at a very late time in my life.
Is that in part because of the fear?
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I went through situations in college where I'd be getting hot and heavy with somebody and then I'd have to stop like in the middle of it. And
go to hell.
And you know, I'm with some like, you know, white chick from Long Island and we're like in the middle of it and I have to explain to her how I can't put the father in my dad's mouth and, you know, if I have premarital sex and they're like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know,
I thought you were cool, but
you're a weirdo band. And it was definitely tough, you know, because I lived with like a lot of guilt. Right. That's really what it was. I lived with a lot of guilt about that. And there was a part of me that wanted to live my life. And there was a part of me that wanted to like satisfy my family and their wishes. So I did the craziest thing. I got into an arranged marriage, which for those of you that don't know, an arranged marriage is when you are meeting girls and you basically decide to marry them. It was kind of like The Bachelor. You remember The Bachelor back in the day. So they lined up a whole bunch of girls in India. I flew to India, met a bunch of girls and then married one of them. And, you know, it was a marriage that was really based on, not that I didn't love her. I definitely loved her and still to this day love her. I have love for her, but it was more like a duty. It felt more like a duty to my family. So long story short, we became really good roommates, you know, and, you know, I liked her a lot, you know, she loved me and I liked her a lot, you know, and it, became a very tough situation. And, you know, in all honesty, if I could just tell the truth, I was, you know, having extramarital affairs. I was cheating. I was doing things and really justifying why I was doing it that like, well, if my parents let me live my life, I wouldn't have to be so dishonest. So it was tough, man. It was tough. I was the black sheep of the family. When I eventually did get divorced, I was divorced with a 4-year-old son and a 6-month-year-old baby girl. So, you know, I was that guy, you know? So very tough at that time, but I knew that for the first time I was standing for myself and I was honoring what was real for me. And I understood that was probably the first time that I really understood what a backbone you have to be able to stand in your, on that hill and be willing to die on that hill.
Right.
And just be unpopular.
Right.
You know, unpopular to your own family, unpopular to her family. So it was definitely not an easy time for probably about 2 years. It was really tough. It wasn't until she moved on and met her guy that I think I was more or less forgiven and I was, you know, let back in the family and so on and so forth. And it was a tough time. And I felt like another thing that was occurring for me was I was still in the family business, even though I wasn't necessarily accepted in other ways from a social point of view. So I had made up that the only value that I really bring to the table is my ability to earn.
Wow.
And that was tough too.
Yeah, I would imagine so. You're carrying this guilt, you're carrying the shame, you're letting your family down, but you're struggling with them because you know this isn't you, this isn't right.
Yeah.
And by right, I mean for you.
Correct.
Because, you know, culture is something that when it comes to America gets watered down because we are a melting pot of cultures. And growing up in the Bronx with Italians and being Indian with all this rich culture, it's just not translating for you.
Yeah.
So you have the courage to step away from this marriage. You have two amazing kids who I've had the pleasure of meeting on multiple occasions, and they've even spent time with my daughter, who loved them very much when they got to hang out. So I know they're good kids. They're going to be great human beings.
Amen.
And you did that in an environment that was initially challenging, but then freeing. And so many people stay in relationships for children and think they're doing the right thing. But you're actually hurting the people that you're trying to help the most. So kudos to you for finding the courage to do that. And you also touched on sales.
Yeah.
Which I always say, and we've said when we've spoken, is the most valuable tool for an entrepreneur.
For sure.
So bring us to this time. You're in the business. What's the business like? We know it's plumbing supplies. We know your father kind of, you know, hung the shingle, but now you're going to take it to the next level. What's that look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, at the time, our issue was sales. The company needed someone to be the face and to go out there and gain exposure and so on and so forth. So that's what I was doing. I was hitting the pavement. At the time, I mentioned to you about the Yellow Pages. You probably also remember those big giant maps that would be stuck on walls with little pins in them. And that's what I would do is every night I would create like a route. And, you know, there was no GPS back then. So my entire route was based on my ability to get on 96th Street and get off at the exit and go to Amsterdam and make a right on this place. So, you know, just building routes.
You're knocking like,
to
on doors stores, now.
Knocking on doors.
Calling random numbers.
Yeah. And it was, you know, I burned the midnight oil. I mean, I had so many maps that I would go through because, you know, when you fold the maps and you open and close them, they would have those seams in the maps. And then you'd put like clear Scotch tape, like to like cover the seams. Oh my God, man. So I remember all those things, man, but we grew exponentially. And for the first time in my life, I really felt like I had made it. And I was 31 years old. I bought my first property. This was not when I was in the real estate game. This was more a property that I wanted to buy to kind of put my stamp on who I was. So went to Manhattan, bought a beautiful pre-construction in Battery Park, Northern Battery Park, $1.8 million property. And you know, for me, like I thought I had made it. Like everything like looked good and smelled good on paper. I had the beautiful kids. I had the beautiful wife. I had the beautiful apartment. I had the thriving business. And yet I was still empty inside. There was still like that knowing that, you know, until I'm fully honest and truthful about, you know, what really matters to me, like all these toys and bells and whistles aren't going to mean anything. So I mentioned to you about getting divorced, going through that whole process. So there was a lot, like while we were growing as a company and parallel to all the financial success, there was definitely like a lot of personal issues that were also kind of affecting that.
Do you think any of the sales training and the ability to hear rejection, is that giving you the same kind of resilience in your life? Or is that something you think you got from elsewhere? I'm just curious.
It's a really good question. I think the sales definitely, business in general, was something that I was always able to kind of compartmentalize. So if I was doing poorly in one area, let's say I was doing poorly in health or I was doing poorly in marriage, I could still lock into work during work. And sometimes work was my salvation, if I could be honest.
Right.
Because sometimes it was just easier to be like, fuck this shit. Like, let me get my coffee. Let me drive to Brooklyn. Let me go visit my Jewish customers in Brooklyn. Then let me go to Chinatown. Let me go hit my Chinese customers in Chinatown. And it was easy to just have that tunnel vision and let go of all my problems and just go, you know what? I'm just going to sell my way out of like, I'm just going to, you know, throw money at my problems.
Right.
You know?
I think so many men that are proficient in work and in business, and women now too, more than ever, obviously. So I don't want to discount that. But people that are business minded and good at what they do tend to do it at the expense of other areas of their life, as you mentioned, whether it's their body or their connection with a higher power or, unfortunately, their families and the people they love the most. So,
yeah, it was tough. And, you know, I'm still, I think, learning what balance is. I think I have a better hold of what balance is to me now, like the definition of what it is to have success in more than one area, like in a variety of different areas. But at the time, I was, you know, thinking that, hey, this is probably the best it's ever going to be. Like, be happy with this. Like, you're financially successful. Everyone thinks that you're happy.
Right.
Everyone thinks and believes that, like, everyone was singing my praises because I guess I had made it, right? Like, I was a kid who was like 21 years old, B student. You know, I was so far ahead of my contemporaries, kids that I went to high school with, kids that I went to college with. I was so far ahead of them. So, you know, these are people that, you know, when they would see me, it was all about like, wow, like, you're doing so well.
Right.
You know, and
it's easy to get lost in that source.
Yeah. And say, yeah, like, yeah, oh yeah. Like, cause I didn't have vulnerability at the time and I didn't have a mentor at that time to really share what I was truly going through. So I think that it was easy to just become like a performer and an actor and just like play the role. Like, okay, you guys think I'm successful, then I'm just going to act like I'm the shit, you know? Right.
And so many of us do it that are fortunate enough to even find success is that we cover ourselves in that success and that gives us our sense of self. Right. But I want to deviate because you mentioned mentor and that's what the show's all about.
Yes.
It's about letting young people know that they can't do this on their own. And unfortunately, they can't do it with the people around them. So they have to seek out mentors or be fortunate enough to have a mentor come into their life that makes an impact. Who were some of the early mentors other than your parents that helped you, whether it be in business or in life?
Yeah, that's a great question. And mentorship. And I really honor, first of all, let me just segue. I really honor what you're up to and all the things that you're doing because, you know, I know that it wasn't easy for you and growing up with your childhood, you know, the fact that you made it and that you're successful, the fact that you would even think about others that are, you know, that very much fit the prototype of your life. So I know that when I'm talking to you like that, that's like, you know, it's like game recognized game. Like I know you get what I'm talking about, but for me,
appreciate you, brother.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. For me, Alan Barr, he was a professor that I had in college and this guy was in our third year. He was teaching a class called entrepreneurship and it's 300 level class. You know, the first year of college, you're taking all these bullshit classes, like all for your prerequisites and stuff like that. But, you know, I really got serious about college when I hit my third year, because I was now into my major, which was business. And I really, for the first time after taking his class on entrepreneurship, started to believe that I could do it too. This guy had such swag. His office hours were outside in the patio instead of in his office. He drove like this ridiculous car and he had so much swag. Like it was one of those 3-hour classes where there'd be like an intermission in the middle for like 20 minutes. And normally people would like walk to a payphone or do whatever they did. You guys know what a payphone is, right? Right.
So, you know, and I was like, damn, we own this shit.
1996. So we would just follow this guy. Like he was a rock star, you know? And I really just admired like his belief. And what I really got, it's so crazy, Sean, like I don't want to sound corny, but like believing in yourself is literally the number one prerequisite. I would even put it over hard work when it comes to success in business and in life, right?
We've discussed it. Without belief, there's nothing.
If you don't believe
plenty
in yourself,
of people work hard. Like,
yeah.
Plenty of people work a lot harder than me. Or yes, you.
Absolutely.
That's not what it's about.
Right.
It's
so about belief. But and it's so funny because it's like what every Disney movie is about, right? Believe in yourself.
Right.
But this guy just had so much swagger about him. And he just believed. Like, I mean, he just literally, like anything he would say, he'd be like, yeah, I'm doing this next year and I'm doing that and I'm doing this. And it was like he was just manifesting. Like there was no evidence of like why that's going to come to fruition, but he just made it so. It's like he could say rock and a fucking rock would come out of his mouth, you know, like true manifestation. So I was like, there's something to this. There's like definitely something about the spoken word and about like affirmations and being able to just fucking call it like, right. Yo, jumper, boom, 2 points, you know, like just being able to call it. You see it in athletes, you see it in guys like Michael Jordan that just, they just know they're going to win. Right. They just know they're going to prevail. So I think that Alan Barr was definitely like a big mentor. He gave me like that swag. He gave me that belief that, you know, on every sales call and every phone call, just go into it knowing that you're going to close.
Right.
And, you know, if you don't, it's a numbers game, you know? Right. So he was big for me. I think I had an uncle in India who is my dad's brother, and he was another one that was just a great, great man. And one of the things that this is back in the 1970s, him and his brothers, my uncles, built the largest building, the tallest building in India at the time. This is in 1982. It was a 39-story building in Delhi. It's still there. It's the State Bank of India. And they spent about 7 years building it. I remember being like a little kid, about 5 or 6 years old. And literally, they had our whole family in a construction site that they built. It was like a compound. And we didn't live in Delhi. We lived in my family lived in Calcutta. And they would fly us from Calcutta to Delhi back and forth. And the project was so big, they would bring like all the people that worked for us, like the servants that would work, the maids and stuff that worked in Calcutta, they would fly them into Delhi. We had like a whole operation going on in Delhi. And it was just really amazing to watch at such a young age how important my family was and how important this one guy is, my uncle. And his political influence, his influence over union leaders and things like that. I would just kind of like sit there and observe this guy having these like big meetings, and he would love to have me around. I was like the American nephew and I was light skinned. And there's like a thing about being light skinned in India.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a thing about it.
I have a buddy who went over there. He's Puerto Rican, but we used to call him White Boy Josh.
Yeah.
In college, because he would, you know, gravitate toward the white kids, but then, you know, the white kids would call him Hip Hop Josh because he was a hip hop DJ. So identity's crazy. But when he went to India, he told me that he would get pulled randomly over by kids to take pictures with and explain to me why. And that shit blew my mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like when I go to India, like even to this day, like people are like, you're Indian? Like it's jarring for them. But as a little kid without a tan, like this beautiful tan that I have now, just, you know, like looking like a ghost in India.
Right.
And my uncle would just keep me around. He'd just have me wherever he was, he would just have me there. Right. And then like he'd have like people coming into meetings. He'd be smoking a cigarette and just having these meetings with 6-year-old JD, right? Right next to him.
I didn't know that about you. That's interesting. So you've seen what winning looks like.
Yeah.
And then you've seen what the grind from zero to some sort of winning.
For sure.
Your parents had to start on their own.
Absolutely. They started with zero. Exactly.
Right. So uncles was great, but that didn't translate to anything.
No,
when you got
not here. They had to start from the beginning. But one of the things about my uncle that was really amazing, I just want to say his name is Gopal Mitra, and God rest his soul. And he said to me, because I used to ask him, like, how are you doing all this? Like all these different meetings and this construction projects. And like, are you afraid that the building's going to fall down? Like all these questions a 6-year-old might ask. Right. And he was like, he told me that his guru, he had talked to his guru back. So I'm going to go back a little bit. So in 1968, he was in Michigan. They were designing the World Trade Center. This is back in the 60s. He was one of 200 architects selected as a team to build the World Trade Center. So World Trade Center.
Wow.
Right. So this guy was a brilliant man. And he told me that he would spend nights. So remember, my question was about him in this 39-story tower. And now he's answering my question by telling me about when he, like 10 years prior about how when he was working on the World Trade Center, he would talk to his guru and he would ask him, is this building going to be able to stand? This is a 100-story building. Like, how is it going to stand? And his guru told him, he said, when God is holding the entire earth, the ball in the air, just suspended in space. Why do you worry about a silly little building? Mm-hmm. And it was profound to me because it was really like a testament to faith in God and that we're not alone and that if we can really work hard, like my parents taught me, have that discipline, that consistency, believe in yourself, like Alan Barr so vividly showed me, and have faith in God. That was really the Holy Trinity. That was that the trifecta.
Absolutely. You know? And that's what I think people don't realize is that it isn't complicated. It starts with some simple things, but then life and attaining and holding on to those things, that's the tough part.
Yeah. Simple, but not easy. So I think it is simple. It's simple in its conceptually, it's simple. But like, as you said, life is going to life you and it's going to contradict so much of what you want to believe to be true.
Right.
Right. And then it's like, damn, is it true?
So you've got the, let's just say genetics, you know, tongue in cheek, right? You've seen some good things, great things. You've been around a great man and your uncle, and you've been around a great man and your father.
For sure.
You built this business up. You've overcome your personal challenges. You are stepping into your identity. You purchased this building, and I really wanted to dive into real estate
because
I think we both agreed that, you know, we want to add some value to the listeners.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the way that we as a people, black, brown, no matter what, or disenfranchised, because that includes poor whites or anybody. The way that we leave a legacy that lasts beyond us, real estate's a big part of that. And, you know, you were in the game before I was in the game. And, you know, I took a lot of what you said and, you know, you were so excited for me because you were like, oh, just wait, give it fucking 10 years and you're going to see what that, you know, that investment is going to turn into.
Right.
And, you know, we want to share that with our listeners, particularly our young listeners, and plant the same kinds of seeds that you were blessed enough to have in your life. So tell us a little bit about your real estate ventures, that journey. And I'm going to just let you go, brother, because I know this is what you're passionate and you're
awesome.
Great at.
Awesome. All right, man. So basically, Michelle and I'll go to 2016. We had a cash flowing business. We were making money. We were able to take nice trips and do a lot of fun stuff and take the kids out. And that was all fine and dandy. But we realized that we were never like saving money. Like for whatever reason, there was like never any money in the bank. Right. But we always had everything. We
guilty.
Had,
yeah.
Right. And we
it's
lived
like a magic pocket.
Very high on the hog.
Less than enough, right?
We lived very high on the hog, but we were like, you know, babe, like why don't we get into like a savings game? Like, let's like try to put away X amount of dollars per month and let's just see, because we want to like buy our first property. So this was a conversation we had in 2015 that led to our first acquisition in 2017. So, we were super nervous because for us, this was our first deal and we didn't go into this thinking that we were going to buy a 5-family commercial property. We thought we were going to buy a 2-family or a 3-family. We didn't know that we were going to buy a 5.
So the $1.8 million in Lower Battery Park that you mentioned, that was for the business.
So no, that was just to live in. That was an apartment back in 2008, 2009. Gotcha. That was during my first marriage.
Okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. But I'm not even including that because that wasn't really a real estate purchase.
Okay. Right, I just wanted to clear that up for anybody because if it wasn't clear to me, it wasn't clear to them.
Absolutely.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Absolutely. Go ahead, so 2015, 2016, now we're saving money. We're saving, we have our cash flowing business. That's our, we'll call it our active income. And then we've got the savings in the bank. And we were looking at property after we probably looked at like 40 or 45 properties. And then, you know, after you look at a lot of properties and you run these numbers over and over, when there's like an anomaly, when there's like a unicorn, it just sticks out. And you're like, wait a minute, that doesn't even make any sense.
These numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, so wait, it's a 5-family and they want how much? $750,000. And I was like, okay, tell me more. And then when we were going through the numbers, I was like, all right, something doesn't make sense. I was talking to the broker and she goes, oh, and I forgot to mention one other thing. And I said, what is that? She goes, the guy died. So it's the daughter that's selling the property. And I was like, ah, so that's the backstory. So I learned in real estate, there's the 4 D's that actually make for a good deal. There's death, disease, divorce, and destruction. So these are the 4 D's that I look for whenever there's like, at least I look for in terms of a backstory. Like if something sticks out like a unicorn where the numbers don't make sense, I try to pry and try to find out, can you tell me a little bit more about the motivation of the seller? Why are they selling? Right? Why am I so lucky to find a five family for $750,000? Right. So just to put that in for your audience, to put that in perspective, we were looking at three families that were going for like $900,000 in New Rochelle at the time. And now you couldn't even find a three family for $900,000 in New Rochelle. Right. But we ran the numbers. It was a home run. And that too, all the apartments were under market. Like these are people that had lived there forever. The landlord never increased the rent. And then we learned that the motivation of the daughter was that she wanted to sell the property because the father had promised his son. It was two of them. It was his daughter and his son. The daughter lived in the house with him and the son didn't live there. The son was promised $150,000 that they didn't have.
Right.
So they were going to sell the property so they can make him whole from the proceeds of the sale. So I was like, okay, that's starting to make sense now. The daughter's motivation, so the son's motivation is he didn't even care about the property. He just wanted his $150,000. The daughter, from what I could understand, was thinking that the house brought bad memories because it was, you know,
so she just wanted to turn the page. Extremely fortunate, you and Michelle.
Extremely fortunate. We ended up paying seven.
And just so everybody knows, when you're buying a multifamily, the name of the game is to look at the rents, because let's say they haven't been raised in 5 years, and anybody who rents, you're going to know that it goes up every year, every 2 years,
absolutely,
if you're lucky, or every 3 to 5, depending on your lease. But for the most part, every year, you're entitled to
absolutely
rent. And this hasn't been done in years. So
you've
got upside potential. You're buying it
massive,
cheap.
Massive.
Yeah. I always say, right, when you finally step into your purpose, God tends to roll out the red carpet for you, as they did in this situation.
I like to say, as the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Nah.
So, you know, we were running through property after, but we would make so many offers and lose.
Right.
We lost on so many offers and we would get disheartened. Michelle would be like upset, like, damn, babe, I really thought that property was ours.
Right.
So that was happening over and over and over. And we were rookies. So, you know, we were emotional, you know, we wanted, you know, we would walk into a property and we always could imagine us like going there and fixing it and all these things. So when we would swing and miss, it was a big deal, but we were working hard and we got lucky because we were working hard. The universe provides, right?
Yes,
the universe rewards. So yes, the rents were very low. And what we were confident is that we could raise these rents. We were confident that we could fix up the property. It hadn't been updated in years. To make a long story short, we took what was at the time about $6,000 or $7,000 in monthly cash flow. Now that same property cash flow is about $16,000 to $17,000 a month.
Wow.
Right. Now, just to put that in like numbers, for example, for a value or resale purpose, the rule of thumb is for every dollar annually that you can raise the rent, your property value goes up by $12. So,
Would you like to repeat that?
Absolutely. If your rent was $1,000, if you could take an apartment that was a two bedroom, and you could raise the rent from $2,000 a month to $3,000 a month, right? What you essentially did was you're earning $12,000 more per year, but what you really did was increase your equity by $144,000, or what amounts to $12 for every dollar you're able to increase the rent annually.
And let's bring that even down a bit. Why is that the name of the game in real estate?
Equity. So basically, I mean, what we were planning is we were going to incrementally raise these rents, fix up these properties, not for the purpose of selling it, just for the purposes of refinancing it later. So the more money that we can have the property be worth, right, at a particular cap rate. I don't want to get too crazy here, but we can talk about that a little bit. But basically, like I said, for every dollar we were able to raise the rent. So in this example, raising it from $7,000 to $17,000, raising it $10,000 per month, which is $120,000 a year times 12, we were able to take a property that was worth $740,000 and, you know, make this property worth about $2 million, right? And, you know, we put 30% down on this loan. So we were in this loan for 450 grand when we started. Now that loan today, 7 years later, is probably, you know, under 400 grand. It's probably like 350 grand at any point. Now rates are, of course, high. But at any point, if we wanted to refinance that property, you know, when rates go back down, we can pull out, you know, 700, 800, you know, basically like a loan to value, 75% loan to value, and pull cash out with the intention of buying more property.
And you hit something on the head. I want to stop there before we move on. And it's because, you know, we're all trained in America to have the White House and the picket fence if you are able to find that success, which has been tough. And hopefully that's going to change in the coming months and coming year as interest rates hopefully fall a little bit and people will be able to buy a home more accessibly. However, for people that don't have generational wealth or people that are really looking to change the game, if you can be patient and be a renter for a little longer or be a tenant in a multifamily situation that you own where you're also getting rent.
Right.
This, in my humble opinion, is a better option than buying a single family home.
Absolutely.
And if you can stave off that desire for that American dream for just a few years,
right,
you can change your life.
Absolutely.
Forever.
Absolutely. I have my son Yogi, who's 18 years old now. He's looking right now because he's, you know, the nut doesn't fall far from the tree.
He's
he's already looking at real estate deals for himself, and he's only 18 years old. So he is looking to do what's called an FHA loan. Right. So for your listeners, an FHA loan, first time home buyer, most people have heard of it, but they probably don't know the nuances of it. So with 3.5% down, you could basically own your first property as long as it's not commercial. So as long as it's not a five family, you can own a four family. You could have a quadruplex.
Five units or better.
Five units or more. Right.
So if you're looking at a fourplex, threeplex, or even a duplex.
Right.
You can qualify for an FHA, which I was going to do for my duplex, but we pulled and then we ended up getting it for our single family home. But nonetheless, most people probably only think that you can get an FHA loan for that single family home. So again,
it's a misconception.
Not as unthinkable as you think. You just have to know the game and how to play it. And also, let's, you know, since we're on that subject and we're bringing it down to the nuts and bolts, we're also going to pay some mortgage insurance on that.
Right.
Because the banks, traditional bank loans, you have to be at 20% down payment.
Right.
In order to qualify for a traditional loan.
Correct.
So FHA at 3.5, you're 16.5 points away from that note. Yeah, but that standard being met.
Correct.
But it's still a better
option. It's still better.
And that's what people don't understand. You don't have to have 20%. And of course, you have to factor in the 5 or 6% for closing costs, but you can do it with 3.5. And that just makes it much more attainable. And I want people to know that because so many people think it is unattainable and so many poor people think it's unattainable.
Right.
But again, that factors into your beliefs.
It does. Well. And you know what? I think people get caught up in rates and rates matter. It's a factor in the whole acquisition. But I would never, for example, in the last deal that I was talking about where I bought the five family, does it really matter what the rate was when I bought the property?
No, because
look at what happened to the property. It went from 700,000 to 2 million. Right. So who cares if I paid 3.5% or if I paid 8% when I bought it in 2016, right? So the same thing holds true here with an FHA loan. Let's say, and this is for you young listeners as well, like for any of you guys who are like 18, 20 years old and you're thinking about your next move, how about you get an FHA loan? You qualify with 1 year to 2 years of W-2s. Some FHA loans you could do with 1 year. So you show your taxes for 1 year, you qualify, and now you live in one unit and you rent out the other three units. And now, more than likely, even with that mortgage insurance that you were referring to, which makes the loan a little bit more pricey than a traditional Fannie or Freddie conventional loan, you now are living at a minimum rent-free. Could you imagine that by the age of 20 years old, you could be taking care of the number one expense for Americans or for people in the world, which is their shelter?
Right.
Imagine being able to take care of that in the first 2 years of adulthood.
Right. And
that's what's possible.
All the while, your tenants are essentially taking on your debt. So you are the guarantor of that debt, but other people are paying it down for you while the property value goes up. And here's another trick that most people don't realize. If you're on a 30-year loan, you guys have all heard of inflation.
Absolutely.
Inflation is a hot button topic since COVID. The actual value of the dollar that you have to pay the bank. Yes, let's say for number's sake, it's $500,000 that you have to pay the bank back. Over the course of 30 years, the actual value is less than because your dollar can buy you less. So not only are you making money on the equity side, you're essentially paying back the bank less than the money is worth.
You're shorting the dollar, essentially.
Shorting the dollar over 30 years. Thank you for saving me from my long-winded explanation.
No, you're good.
And, you know, it may seem ridiculous that a bank will essentially double their money on you over the course of 30 years, but they take that into account, and that's why they're the bank. But you're winning because you're still paying back dollar for dollar a shorter amount of money.
You win every single time. Sean, I think we live in the greatest country in the world, a country in which you could literally borrow 80% from a bank. You can go down the block to like your local credit union or bank, and you can put down 20% on a traditional mortgage, and you can borrow 80%.
Right.
Show me another deal that can do that. Show me the stock market where the stock market
can do that. It doesn't work like that in other countries.
And
I want people to understand that, you know, nothing relieves the chip from your shoulder like the feeling of success. And these are two successful guys talking here. So if this is being lost on you or if it's over your head, because I read some of the comments and people are like, oh, you lost me at this amount of money. That's a belief that they have. That's a limiting belief. And I want them to turn the mirror in on themselves and understand that this is a system. This is a game. But we need to learn the fucking rules of the game so we can play it better. And here are two brown men who come from the Bronx trying to teach you. So if you want to talk yourself out of it, that's your problem. Listen up and learn, because that's what we're trying to do here, which is plant seeds and let you understand that you too are worthy of the American dream. And if you've never had a piece of it, it is alive and well.
Absolutely.
Turn off your fucking TV, because at the end of the day, it's all doom and gloom. But the American dream, I like to say, is alive and well for those who have never had a piece of it. And that was your family's destiny. Yeah. And now it is yours.
Amen.
I'm blessed enough to have it as mine.
And our children's.
Well, we're going to pass this down to our children, but I also want to challenge you to pass it down to whoever you can at this point, because I know you've got an amazing heart.
Yeah.
And sometimes we get lost in our own stuff, but you've got a light that I want you to shine and you've got knowledge need to share.
I appreciate it beyond the household. I do. And I get excited about stuff like this, you know, like for me, you know, I think when I talk to Michelle, I'm like, yeah, you know, like, people ask me questions about this stuff and I just think it's kind of common sense, but I realize that it's not, like this stuff, just like certain things come natural to certain people. This just comes natural to me. It just clicks.
And I want you to realize that's because you were blessed enough to have a great upbringing and great people.
Yeah.
But I also want you to realize that there aren't people as fortunate as you were.
Amen.
And there aren't as people as fortunate as even I was
to
have a loving single mom who didn't know any of this shit. I had to learn this on my own. But that's why I'm on such a passionate mission to stop that bullshit.
Because absolutely.
Somebody's got to show people that they can do it too.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you coming and telling us all this stuff. So you've done the multifamily deal now, and that changes the trajectory of the game for you. What's next after that?
Next. So the multifamily was going well. And we were, you know, we never go into a deal, Sean, thinking that we're going to go in one direction or another. It's kind of like, you know what? Let's just see. Let's just see what presents itself. So we're always looking. We have brokers. We give them kind of like search criterias that this is what we're looking for. And the pandemic happens. So when the pandemic happens, we were in the middle of doing a fix and flip. So we're doing a fix and flip in Stamford, Connecticut. I bought this property at a blind auction. I wanted to test my hand in fix and flip. So now we're buying distressed properties. We're getting a crew in there. We're fixing up the properties. We're putting them on the market. We're selling them. We're doing it in Orange County. We're doing well. But I started to realize that this is like a lot of work to get a check. Like, and then the closing happens and then you get your check and you get out. I'm like, for that, I could just run my plumbing business because I know how to operate that already. Like, why would I need to do another business for active income? And I started to say to myself, maybe our next move is to buy and hold and actually hold on to the property. But what would we hold on to it for? And that's where vacation rental started to become something that was interesting to me. And then we had this perfect opportunity that presented itself because we bought this property for $310,000 in Stamford, Connecticut, blind auction. And for those of you who don't know, blind auction literally means you cannot see the inside of the property. So where I'm standing out there, there's Google like one of those lawyers, referees, there's a bidding going on, and there's me and about four other people bidding. We win the auction. Congratulations, you own this house. When we go inside the house, there's a lot of problems with the house, understandably. We had a $200,000 budget that we went, no, sorry, we had a $150,000 budget that we went way over budget on. We ended up spending more like $200,000 to $210,000. When it was time to list the property on the market, we were trying to list the property for $685,000. We had paid $310,000, and we were not getting any bites. And it was pretty disheartening because we had staged the property. We had done all the things that we knew what to do. But for whatever reason, the market was just not a good market at the time. And then Michelle and I decided, why don't we refinance this property? We have a lot of equity in the property because we only paid $310,000 for the property. We decided to refinance. We pulled cash out. We used some of that cash to furnish the property. We actually ended up getting the same woman who staged the property. And we said, can you make it like more funky and less like vanilla and make it like, you know, like more fun.
Right. And inviting somebody right. Want to stay there.
So she did this crazy design where she put like deer antlers and a Game of Thrones table, like this long table. She did a lot of funky stuff, all these like photographs of like Marilyn Monroe and a lot of black and whites. And she made it like this cool, funky, vintage like house. And then Michelle and I, we did the sales copy. We took some professional photographs. I don't even think we took professional photographs. We actually just used our iPhone to do it.
Photographs.
Yeah. And we just threw it up and we were like, let's see what happens. So we put it on an Airbnb. And Sean, like, I kid you not, like, within 3 or 4 hours, like every weekend was taken, like every weekend for the rest of the year was booked solid. And we were like, holy shit, I think we just found something. And it was doing
the harder you work and the more luckier chances you take, the luckier you get.
Say it again. The harder you work, the harder I work, the luckier I get. So we were like, holy shit, like this is really like we were killing the game with this thing. We were getting bookings that was like $13,000 a month on a small property that was about 1,500 square feet. It had a beautiful piece of land, but it was a small house. And people were paying $450 a night, $550 a night to stay here. Wow. On the weekdays, they're still paying like $375 a night. And we're like, man, we are. So
this
we.
Is better.
This is amazing. Expected. Amazing. And then we had refinanced. We held that property. We still have that property today. And we were like, all right, let's get another one. Let's do another one. This time, let's do it on a body of water. So we weren't at a position where we were confident enough to buy like an oceanfront property. Right. But we were like, let's look at upstate New York for lake homes. And we found this beautiful lake home. Remember I told you the four D's, death, disease, destruction, and divorce, right? So this guy was another, we were searching property after property after property, and this was the unicorn. And we're like, $458,000 for this property. What's wrong with it? Right. Like the property itself looks amazing. We walked into the property because we saw the photographs online. Michelle and I, we had our game face on. We walk into this stunning property, this elaborate professional kitchen, living room that was like vaulted ceilings, 25-foot ceilings, gorgeous lake in front of us.
And windows. And
windows from floor to ceiling. The whole bells and whistles. I mean, Sean, this was like a dream house. Like we would, like I was in the living room, like I want to die in this. I want to take my last breath in this living room. It was gorgeous. And Michelle, Miss Negotiator, literally turns to the broker and says, so my husband has a check with him. And I'm looking at her like, are you going to go upstairs and see the bedrooms? And it was just like, what happened to your game face? Like, but I understood what she was going through because I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, how in the world? This is like a robbery without a gun. Right. How in the world is this $458,000? We ended up negotiating it down to $418,000. The guy gave us all the furnishings for free because now here comes the backstory, the four D's. His wife died. He was 76 years old. He was semi-retired. He was living most of his time in South Carolina. It was hard for him to maintain the house because it was a 4,800 square foot house, had six bedrooms, stunning piece of land right on the lake. And it was a robbery without a gun. It was just seamless. And we ended up putting in probably about $50,000 to $60,000 right, of upgrades,
which is nothing. Kind of property, because you spent five times that on a smaller, non-comparable property.
Exactly, but the property was gorgeous already. When I say upgrades, I'm talking about like 3D tile on the the like not just nothing constructional. Yeah, exactly. Stunning property. Again, we put it on Airbnb. We wait. And this thing was bringing in $1,000 a night. $1,000 a night from Memorial Day to Labor Day. I mean, we were paying our mortgage was, and we had a high interest rate on that one. We didn't even get it at a good.
This is when we were around six, I think.
Yeah. So this is great for your audience. We ended up paying almost 7%. And Michelle and I were like not happy about that. But we were, again, we were kind of measuring like how unhappy are we? Like, are we that's upset enough that we're going to walk away from the deal? Yeah. No, this property is worth over $1 million today. And like I said, we paid $418,000 for it. We put very little money into the property but we'd never sell it because the cash flow is like crazy. Yeah. So this thing, literally our mortgage, I was getting to the mortgage. So our principal interest taxes insurance for this property is $3,348 a month.
That's cheaper than mine.
So times 12, we're talking about 40 grand a year is the entire nut for this property. Sorry.
At $1,000 a night.
$1,000 a night. So we basically pay all of our expenses in the summertime for this property. And then it's just gravy from that point on. Now there's a lot of maintenance on the property, right? We get paid for our aggravation, of course. So there's no reward without some headaches involved. So none of this is peaches and cream. Obviously, it takes a lot of resources and good people around you to do the Airbnb business, because there is this, when people are paying $1,000 a night, they obviously have a certain level of expectation.
Right.
So, you know, the hot tub has to be clean. You know, the property has to be immaculate. The towels have to be clean. The mattresses have to be, you know, everything has to be top notch. But, you know, that's where your team comes in. That's where, you know, having a good cleaning lady is like basically like your partner in your business. She's like your eyes and ears to everything. Right. So, you know, really our team was having a good cleaning lady, having a great handyman, and then the trades like a plumber, master, you know, plumber and electrician if you need it. But basically, if you have a good enough handyman who can pretty much do anything, that's all you really need. You need a guy who's local, who can come there on the fly in case something goes wrong, and a cleaning lady that can come in for like the stupid things like, hey, there's no batteries in the TV remote, or they're dead. Are there AA batteries in the house? Are they in the maid's closet? No, but we'll run them over to you right now.
And how many properties are you at now that you're Airbnb-ing?
Airbnb is six.
Six properties. So we're not going to get into all of them, but right. I want people to understand that this is like anything else. Stacked over time.
Absolutely.
And patience. So this is almost over the course of the last 8 years.
Yeah, seven years. 2016 was our first investment. We're in 24, so about seven and a half years.
A property every year and a quarter, let's just say, for rounding up sake.
Yeah.
So this isn't something that happens overnight, but it's wins. And then those wins and that equity allows you to then borrow again.
Absolutely.
And then you actually start to get creative and you can go to different banks.
Absolutely.
So, you know, people need to have a long-term vision. But they need to do the work.
Yeah.
And it's not like you even foresaw this happening. You went in with the single family flip. This opportunity presents itself. Oh, wait, this opportunity is sexy. Now you're applying the same work ethic to something that's more fruitful, cash flows better.
Yeah.
And just, you know what deals to get away from. You've got the right team in place. Right. But I just want people to know that this is a marathon, especially the young people who are in an instant gratification world.
Yeah.
And there's so much disappointment that they have in themselves at such a young age. I was at a men's leadership event yesterday, and some of the guys would get up and speak, and they're 24, 25, and they're disappointed at where they're at. And I'm like, what?
24, it's amazing.
I had no fucking clue. I was just hanging out.
We had to reinvent ourselves so many times.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I mean, that's the pressure that I think they're under, because nobody takes the time to explain to them how they got to the place that they got.
Right.
They just see because the that's what they we're see the seeing. Result. They right. see the results. They don't right. see the work. How would somebody who has very limited means, we talked about it, get into the Airbnb game? Because there's also another side of it, which is considered
arbitrage,
the lower hanging fruit.
Correct. So, I mean, this is another way, and it's really something that a lot of young people are just killing the game on right now, which is not buying the property and essentially just renting and re-renting. So they're essentially going to a homeowner and they're saying, we'd like to rent your property. Let's say the house is for rent or the apartment's for rent. And, you know, they show them the property, they show them whatever tax returns, whatever they have to do to qualify. And then they tell them that we're not going to actually live here. What we're going to do is furnish your house and we're going to professionally manage it. We run the Airbnb business. Are you familiar with Airbnb? Of course, everybody nowadays says right. yes. And then they say, okay, great. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a cleaning staff that cleans this house 3 times a week. Basically before and after turnovers, and they're going to do a 5-star job because we live and die by our reviews. Your tenant may never clean the place,
right?
So no one is going to take care of your property better than us because it's in our financial interest to do so. And what we hope is that we can have this property because it's going to cost us a lot of money up front to get it ready. So we're hoping that we can get a 2-year lease with an option for a 3rd year. So with the right owner and a person who's a bit open-minded, this has become a great pitch where a lot of young people are being able to get in with first month's rent, security deposit, business in a box. So they're furnishing this thing and they're in business.
And that's something that you would have to do just to rent an apartment.
Yeah.
So again, you know, if you can stave off your desire to make your lifestyle better for just a little longer, there are ways that you can build, you know, wealth, and it doesn't necessarily have to be out of reach. And
yeah. I mean, I've told the kids, so Yogi and Zeller are 18 and 14, and I told them, I said, listen, after college, whatever you end up doing, I am so for you living in the house. And like, all I need to know from you is that you're productive. You're either going to school or you're making money. And then that money that you're making, I would love for that to be your seed money for some venture that you have down the road. There's no point in you living on your own just to say you're an adult, just to say that you did. You're more than welcome to live here. You'll have your privacy. You'll have all that. But I really want you to grow in an accelerated way in your 20s and not be dumb like your dad, because, you know, I was blowing money left and right, chasing tail, chasing girls, doing all kinds of things to make myself feel better, prop myself up like I was somebody. And, you know, a lot of wasted years. I wouldn't say wasted years because I think it was important. It was an important part of my journey, but I hope that it doesn't have to be a part of their journey, because I've shortened that learning curve for them that, you know what? Have a solid foundation, you know, have a great family structure, save money, live at home, and build your business, build your whatever it is, whatever venture you're going to get into. Instead of spending it on some landlord's rent, spend it on your first investment. So like, this is a perfect example, like doing arbitrage right now, you know, for a kid at home listening to this podcast, you know, who's maybe, you know, 20, 25 years old, something like that. Maybe he's making money at his job, his full-time job. If you can live at home and you can save that money and you can take that same $2,000 and instead of spending it at a landlord, you can spend it, you can save 6 months of it, and you can put yourself in a position where you can rent an apartment or rent a home, put first month's security, last month's security. You can go to Bob's Furniture and you could do even a finance deal, 0% interest for six years, 72 months. You could get the whole place furnished. You could do the same thing at Best Buy and get the TVs and so on and so forth. And you got a business in a box. box. Yeah. And now you're paying a landlord maybe $2,000 and you're getting $6,000 a month in bookings. And after you pay your cleaning fees and your utility bills and your high speed internet, you might be walking away with $2,000 a month passively. Right. That's $24,000 a year. And that's one property. Imagine if you could rinse and repeat that and do that with 10 properties.
And also, I want people to know the difference between earned income and passive income now that you touched on it. So what are the differences as far as taxation?
So with active, you know, there's your active income side and there's your passive income side. So the way that I know it, in terms of the way that I've been practicing it, is in all the properties that we own, we depreciate our assets, right? So we are able to get extremely great tax savings, both on repairs, repair costs, on everything that we put in. All those things are write off. So whatever my adjusted gross income is from my active income from my plumbing business, on my Schedule C, I believe, don't quote me on that, but basically there's a section for real estate. Mm-hmm. And on that, we are depreciating, like just our tax return from 2024, we were able to depreciate $177,000 right off our adjusted gross income in depreciation, which is a fictitious loss, if we could be honest. It's just right. It's just a paper loss on
but
paper.
But it is something that is available.
It's completely
to
legal.
And completely legal.
It's completely
and
legal.
I know people get up in arms about this, but the truth is, this is the fucking game.
This is the game.
So don't get mad at the game. Learn how to play it.
Learn how to play it.
If you're still trading your time for money and you have a desire to exit that cycle of being taxed on every dollar you earn at a certain rate, real estate is the way to go. Any successful person,
absolutely,
down to the Forbes 500 list, has made their money through one stream of income. But the generational wealth that they have created is always through real estate.
Absolutely.
And other investments.
90% of millionaires are millionaires through real estate. Doesn't matter what they did for a living, right, but they're millionaires in real estate. And here's the thing, not to get too political, but it really doesn't matter if there's a Republican administration or a Democrat, because the commonality about all politicians is that they're all rich. So whether you're Donald Trump rich or you're Bernie Sanders rich, they're all rich.
Right.
So they're never going to write.
Rich,
yeah,
right.
They're never going to write legislation that is actually going to take away from the benefits of wealthy people, right, who are in real estate. So for example, things like depreciation are always going to be out there. There's things like cost segregation reports. And again, I don't want to get into great detail, but you can accelerate depreciation, uh-huh, just by doing a cost segregation report. So
I've
there's
talked
either
about
ways
it before, because that's something that, you know, I'm very attracted to.
I'm sure. Yeah. With commercial, with the things that you're doing, I'm sure that's going to come into play as well. But there's just so much opportunity to be able to get rich in this country and not pay taxes. And again, like if we can get away from the politics of it, of, oh, the rich are not paying their fair, they're never going to pay their fair share in taxes because the government will never write laws to have them do that. So rather than talk about the politics of it, let's just accept the reality,
right,
which is that the wealthy in this country are always going to own real estate. They're always going to depreciate real estate, and they're always going to write that off of their adjusted gross income and not pay taxes.
Right. And I just want my people to understand that we're doing this out of a desire to educate them on the things that school will never teach you.
Right.
And that goes across all color lines. It's just a matter of those in the know and those who don't.
Absolutely.
And our job, thank you today, my brother, was to educate those and let them know in case they didn't know. So I am honored for you to have shared your knowledge with us today. And I'm very thankful, and I hope our audience understands and values what you just dropped here today, because you've done it from someone who was blessed enough to have a little bit of a leg up, but you earned your own way. I want to keep that straight. And then you also introduced the concept of arbitrage, which is maybe not known, but accessible to people on a much, much, much more reasonable level.
Absolutely.
So if you choose to stay the same, just know that that's on you. And that's all we're trying to do here. We're not trying to point the finger, but asking for everything to change to accommodate you is part of the problem today. I always like to leave my guests with a question, which is, you spoke about coming from a culture that dates back centuries, a rich culture, a beautiful culture, an inward-looking culture. What do you want JD's legacy to be?
Wow. Mm. I want to be known as somebody that made a difference, that really paid it forward. And I feel that the best way that I can do that is through some of the wisdoms that I was lucky enough to get. This entire conversation, this podcast, there's a lot at stake here. We're talking about the American dream, and we're literally talking about living a life where you can earn money in this country and become wealthy. You can do it with a tax benefit where you're not paying taxes, and you can do it passively where you can have six Saturdays and a Sunday to do with your time what it is you want to do with your time. So I would ask for all of you to really start to think about, what would you do with your time? Like, if you can have all the money in the world and you can have all the benefits, what would you do with your time? And I think that that is really at the core of what motivates me. Is I'm a family man. So for me, what I want to be remembered for is being a family man first, somebody who put his kids and his wife first and really just enjoys the simple pleasures. I don't feel like I have guilty pleasures. I feel like all my pleasures are really just the simplest things, hanging out, watching Netflix with Zella, watching scary movies, going outside to get Froyo, going to the gym with my son, you know, doing romantic things with my wife. And, you know, like, it's just the simple things in life. I think that we all strive to grow up quick and become adults. But then as we get older, it's almost like now I want to be a kid again. It's like we yearn to go back. So I think for all of us, there's a kid inside of us that wants to be silly and adventurous and playful. And that's the success I wish for everyone, is that we can realize that we can self-realize who is the kid inside of us and that we're willing to do the work to do that. I mean, I really feel like I work hard so I can hardly work, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense, brother. And I don't think there's a better way to end it. Let the people know where they can find you. I want you to look into that camera. Let them know where they can find you online, just to follow you and a bit of your journey. And if they need to reach out and ask you any more questions, would you be willing to share?
Absolutely. My name is JD Mitra. You can find me on Facebook on JD Mitra or on Instagram. This is JD Mitra. And yes, I'd be happy to, you know, if you want to DM me, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And how about we do another one of these? This would be great to do again. So
don't threaten me with a good time.
So yeah, I'd be more than honored. And to be honest with you, this is one of the things that makes me come alive, is being able to share my wisdom and actually pay it forward. So you'd be doing me a great service and a great favor by allowing me to give you the gift of giving. So thank you for that. And I look forward.
Awesome, my brother. I appreciate you again. Thank you. Pull that forward.
You got it, baby.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you.